Revision Commission Subcommittee Number 3, 6 p.m. Tuesday, April 15, 1969, Room 421, Capitol Building. Today's subject, inchoate crime, preliminary draft number 1.
Eventually did.
Since we're starting out a new topic, the inchoate crimes, and we're going to be using some terms that are kind of slippery, because you speak of incomplete conduct and complete conduct and substantive crimes and inchoate crimes. So I thought perhaps I'd chart out what we're going to be talking about. And this is probably old news to a lot of you, but I like to kind of look at this thing myself, so I'm going to do it. Over here we got a wall safe in a house. And it's got jewels in it. And obviously is might be the focal point of a person bent on stealing those jewels. Now the law of theft certainly covers that part of it when somebody breaks in and opens the safe. So we've got a definition of crime that draws the line between the criminal act and the innocent conduct, which is going to be on this side of the line. So over here we got theft, that's quick. Or larceny, as it still actually exists in this state. Now, the only trouble with having the line here and stopping is that it doesn't give the police the opportunity to intervene at an earlier stage to prevent the dangerous act of theft in the home from taking place. So, one of the ways we have that's developed and evolved, and took a lot of work to evolve this, is the crime of burglary. All right, so we'll put burglary down here. And this moves the line farther back then toward the innocent conduct and away from the substantive crime of theft. Now, burglary is an interesting crime, and in itself is an inchoate crime. It's really incomplete criminal conduct we're talking about, because as we remember, the traditional definition is breaking and entering with intent to commit another crime. So it in itself is inchoate criminal conduct. As a matter of fact, I think historically, the old common law crime of attempt was very strict, and it only defined the crime of attempt in terms of the last proximate act doctrine. And burglary was one of the crimes that evolved out of that to soften that doctrine to allow the police to interfere earlier than having to wait until the last proximate act, which would have been, of course, just about to the point of opening the safe. Now, the line is back farther, but that doesn't seem to be far enough for purposes of allowing intervention at an earlier stage to prevent this criminal conduct. So we have the next stage, I guess, we'll just call it attempt in here. Actually, we're going to see that attempt will go all the way back into here. But for the moment, let's draw the line there. And in the crime of attempt now, we get into some of the imponderables, the hard drafting and the difficulties the courts have in describing the difference, let's say, between preparation over here, the act of mere preparation, and the point along this continuum somewhere where the acts become the crime, the defined crime of attempt. And of course we see that attempt is definitely readily identifiable as an inchoate, incomplete criminal conduct. Somewhere along the line, the fellow that's attempting this or preparing to do it wants to commit theft, but he hasn't. If we go back to this edge and look at the very earliest acts of preparation, he hasn't crossed this invisible barrier someplace that has raised his conduct from the innocent to the criminal, known generally as attempt. Well, one of the sections will attempt, the Model Penal Code following it, will attempt to pinpoint as close as possible within reason the imaginary line on this line beyond which the crime of attempt is committed. Well, that's not the end of it, of course. With respect to our jewel theft over here, we have a couple more things that might come in here. One of them might be possession of burglar's tools. All right, now this should be viewed actually as part of the attempt problem. Obtaining burglar's tools and having them with the intent to use them certainly is part of the attempted scheme of theft. But like burglary, possession of burglar's tools has become identified as a substantive crime, although it's still in code conduct. Obviously, he hasn't done anything except he's managed to get the tools together. So, actually, the possession of tools might fit on this continuum somewhere as part of the preparation leading to the burglary, which, of course, may lead to the theft. Now, I suppose the farther we get away from the identifiable crime of theft, the substantive crime, and the farther back we get toward innocent conduct, the more difficulty we're in philosophically, because we're beginning to punish, in a sense, for thoughts without important acts. Now, possession of burglar's tools, in large measure, is punishment for thought. He's got tools, that's the act of getting the tools together, certainly, but he's now thinking in terms of crime, but not doing anything that we can identify definitely as an attempt to steal the particular jewels over here in that particular house. Now, in addition, the other two important inchoate crimes, somewhere along this line, would be solicitation and conspiracy. Put them down here together because actually they're kind of alike. It's been said that solicitation is an attempt to conspire. And that's a pretty good definition, really, because where one solicits, commands, and encourages another to steal the jewels in this house, he's committed the crime of solicitation. When and if the other person agrees, then the crime becomes conspiracy as well. So we have a solicitation followed by the agreement. The attempt to get the agreement, followed by the agreement, is a conspiracy. So the two are closely related. Now, here again, where the emphasis is not so much on what they do, the act along the line of breaking in or entering or perhaps getting the tools, it's what they agree to. And we get into the verbal act, moving away from the more identified, sometimes more less equivocal acts of the actual preparation for breaking in. In other words, we're leaning heavily on punishing guilty thoughts back here, which goes contrary to our old concepts of mens rea. But we're not through yet, really, although we're not going to deal with the last one. We're closer yet to the innocent conduct. Here is the person, back here. And he's still innocent. He's got a little halo around his head. He's standing on the street corner, and somewhere in his little brain, he may be thinking about this safe, wall safe over here. Well, we have found yet a way to reach him standing on the corner, and we call it vagrancy. The crime of vagrancy is a substantive crime, certainly, but it's still in court, it's still in incomplete criminal conduct. And when the person is standing on the corner at 2 o'clock in the morning, doing nothing, the vagrancy statute is often defined in very terms. If you may not be on the street between certain hours doing nothing without any regular business, and this is the old status criminality that is under attack in most places and is losing ground rapidly. You can't, in other words, punish the man for not having a job, but merely the thought. He's doing nothing but standing there. Now, I'm not talking about the vagrancy kind of statute that's defined in terms of acts like disorderly conduct or gambling, but the kind of the conduct that recently has been thrown out of the municipal court over the city of Portland by our Supreme Court. All right, that's a brief picture of what we're going to have to deal with. Now, obviously, these things, there are other kinds of inchoate crimes along those lines that I've drawn. But we must remember, I guess, the important part of our job is to decide how far we want to move the line back from the final identifiable crime or substantive crime of theft toward the innocent conduct, which may be called vagrancy. And I think that I have covered what our main problems will be, and I think if we keep in mind the relationships of the statutes like this and what definitions we're making, it might be a little easier.
Okay.
That's a 5-minute handy dandy.
Yeah.
That line of attempt that I stopped there actually goes way on back and could include up into burglary as far as the theft goes, too. And you've got acts all the way along that line. We've got to identify the point along that line, distinguishing between the innocent conduct of mere preparation and the criminal conduct when it rises to a crime of attempt.
Okay. think that we begin this draft with that very problem, defining attempt. The thrust of the Model Penal Code, which is reflected in the draft here, is to speak in terms of the dangerousness of the personality of the person, to draft a statute that enables us to identify the person as the main part rather than his act. His act is secondary. So in order to do that, the Model Penal Code chooses to use the draft, which is largely reflected here, although slightly modified. It speaks in terms of a substantial, now let's see, purposely engages in conduct which would constitute such crime by performing or omitting to perform an act which constitutes a substantial step. In the explanation here of the comment, I reflect the California approach to include as legislative history certain kinds of conduct which would not be held inadequate as within law of constituting what a substantial step is, corroborating the intent of the person who's performing the act to eventually commit the crime toward which he's aiming. And those are listed on page 3 of the draft. Now, the Model Penal Code includes these in the actual draft. And I don't feel real strongly about it one way or another, except that it seemed cumbersome to include those within the draft, where we might accomplish the same thing by legislative history.
What you're saying here is that if one or more of these characteristics accompany the attempt, that is enough to make it a jury question.
Yes.
Whether or not the substantial step has been
performed. That's right.
Jerry, one place we get away from some of the other codes is by this crime of omission as a part of attempt. What type of conduct are we trying to cover with that?
Well, I think the thoughts come to mind. I'm sure there are better examples, but I can think of a case where a woman let her child starve to death in the attic, and she consciously did it. Intentionally kill a child by an act of omission, by failing to feed it, care for it. This would be covered by this kind of a provision. There are lots of crimes committed by omissions intentionally to prevent, that is to allow harm to occur where you are under a duty and can prevent it.
I have a question on the drafting of that. You say by performing or omitting to perform an act which constitutes and so forth substantial step. I marked down here when I first went through there suggesting an amendment so that it would read performing or omitting to perform an act which performance or omission constitutes a substantial step. In other words, the omitting, if you say omitting to perform an act which constitutes a substantial step, someone is likely to come along and say, well, is it the act which constitutes a substantial step? And if he omitted to perform it, how could it be a crime? As opposed to, as I understand the thrust, the performance or the omission in and of itself is a substantial step that you're aiming at.
Yeah, so you would have it read, such crime by performing or omitting to perform an act which performance or omission constitutes
a substantial step.
Sure.
I was also bothered, like Dave was, or maybe not bothered, of what omissions would be substantial steps. It's hard for me to think of.
I think maybe covers it even better when it says engages in conduct which tends to affect the commission of such crime.
Well, conduct means you're doing something and probably would not include omitting to do something.
No, I think in your example of the woman who puts her child in the attic and lets him starve to death, she's engaging in conduct. She has control over the child and places him in the attic and doesn't feed
him. She's committing a separate crime or failing to support too. the interim period, but I suppose that spec being the state of Tapcott, the coroner's negligent homicide, you might have a failure to perform an act, attempted negligent homicide, where you have the seriously maimed person and not.
It wouldn't fit, Frank, because the word purposely is in here. And, of course, a crime of negligent homicide would not have within it that word of definition. The conduct must be the conduct or omission, performance or omission of the act must be purposeful. And purposeful now, I suppose, has become attempt, hasn't it, in your definitions?
Intentionally.
Yeah,
all right.
I still, when I say purposely, I'm still using the Model Penal Code.
Yeah.
Highest mens rea element.
Yeah, and that's their counterpart of intentionally.
Yeah.
I've got a question here. Sometimes when I read it, it sounds all right to me, and sometimes when I read it, it worries me, so I may be just hung up on something.
Sometimes when you read it, you think you're going to lose the case.
Yeah. Sometimes I can see the defense raising this objection and seeing some judge go along with it. That's the problem. And that is when he purposely engages in conduct which would constitute such crime. Now, if you relate that back to the guilty of the crime of attempt, you're okay. But if you relate that engages in conduct which would constitute such crime, if you're referring to the crime attempted, then you're back in the situation where you're drawn right up to the last possible act before the commission of the offense.
Well,
does that seem that way to you?
The phrase substantial step, I think, then qualifies the statement as you presented it. It doesn't have to be that you aren't drawn that close, because purposeful takes away from it the negligence element, and the substantial step moves it back from the old last proximate act doctrine. And back past things like the close proximity doctrine and res ipsa loquitur was another doctrine that was used in the attempt. So it's somewhere back in the middle range.
You want to get back before the prying on the door.
Right. As far back as is consistent with justice.
And
well, take your hypothetical here on the board. In other words, a guy, let's say he's a second story man, and he's got a ladder in his car. Obviously, there's some. You spoke of the continuum there. As he's driving down the street with the ladder in the car, and he gets near the place and opens the trunk lid and takes the ladder out, and a variety of steps, and somewhere along the way, you're going to say, okay, that is enough to make a jury question on attempt. And surely, if he's got the ladder up against the window, but he hasn't stepped on the bottom rung yet, you're going to at least say there's a jury question, aren't you?
Oh, yeah. It is a jury question. This certainly doesn't settle the issue. It doesn't just say squarely what's the difference. It leaves it on the basis that will enable police to interfere earlier than under some of the older, more strict doctrines, last proximate act, res ipsa loquitur, and a couple of those other things, where the cases insist that the conduct is much closer to the substantive crime than this doctrine is. And they emphasize again not what the person's personality is, not his setting out to do the crime and having it as his purpose to do it, but actually what he does. And that's really not the important thing. To reach the dangerousness of the person, you've got to get him earlier than when he actually has got the ladder up against the wall or is very close to that particular stage. In the older cases, in the older doctrines, say, sorry police, if you arrest him before then, you haven't got a leg to stand on.
Well, as a practical matter though, the attempt even now under this would have to have gone far enough so that you could pick out the specific object. I mean, you can't just allege attempted did then and there on the night of February 9th attempt a burglary. You've got to allege what house and where and when. And
that's right.
And so,
you
so
prove
still,
purpose,
if you've got the burglar driving around the streets, late hours, I mean, the police can suspect that he's going to hit someplace, but until it's gone far enough that they can show what he was going to hit, like, I mean, taking out the ladder and stuff in front of this house or in the alley behind this house, I mean, then they can maybe figure it, but otherwise they're...
Well, if he's got burglar's
about
tools,
the streets and highways,
he's got burglar's tools, hours. He can certainly be picked up at an early stage. Mm-hmm. We don't have to worry about how close he gets to his house. He may be clear across town, mm-hmm. as long as he's got the burglar's tools and the purpose and you can show it.
But getting back to my question, this doesn't cause any, this engages in conduct which would constitute such crime. And of course, preparation wouldn't constitute burglary. I mean, mm-hmm. or even... getting close wouldn't constitute burglary. Taking the ladder out of the car wouldn't constitute burglary.
Right. Depends on where you are.
So that this would constitute such crime. Does that refer, are you referring there to the crime of attempt? Or are you referring to the crime of burglary?
I think we're talking about burglary or theft in this case, the ultimate goal.
Would it be engages in conduct toward the commission of the crime?
No, he engages in conduct.
Such crime. See, to
which
commit a crime.
Which would constitute such crime, you see.
Well,
but
a person is guilty of an attempt.
Hmm?
A person is guilty of an attempt to commit a crime. Theft. When he engages in conduct or so forth, which constitutes such crime. Theft. Such crime refers back to crime, and crime is the ultimate goal, following the phrase attempt in it. Now, I'm not wedded to the language here. I want to point out that I'm trying to relate these words, but someone sees a better way to phrase it, I'm delighted to change it.
I'd like to say this, if I could, and of course, when you were drafting this, obviously some of these culpability terms that are still in subcommittee, it's hard to know what we're doing, but conduct has been defined in our preliminary draft on culpability, and it's defined as meaning an act or omission and its accompanying mental state. So I think with that in mind, this
could be simplified. Right.
Right. But I wonder, now, would I be running contrary to what you're intending here if we eliminated the phrase after conduct in the second line, eliminated the phrase from starting with which and down to act, and then so it would read, a person is guilty of an attempt to commit a crime when he intentionally engaged in conduct which constitutes a substantial step towards commission of the crime.
Well, I would think you'd want to leave which would constitute such crime.
Well, that's the thing that bothers me.
Yeah, I think that's
The term that bothers me. I'm going to get judged to rule that that means conduct which would constitute such crime means the crime of burglary, not the crime of attempt, and that... it's got to almost be a completed burglary before you've got the crime of attempt.
Isn't the conduct we're concerned with the conduct which is the step towards the commission of the crime rather mm-hmm. than the conduct that would be the crime itself?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Don's approach would take care of my hang-up on omissions, too.
Mm-hmm.
I really like the wording in the Illinois Code, which throws in the specific offense as well.
That, let's see.
A person commits an attempt when with intent to commit a specific offense.
That?
Any act which constitutes a substantial step towards commission of that offense. And I read the commentary, but I still have specific intent.
That will, unfortunately, restrict the attempt, the breadth of it. Because there are, then you get into the old common law problems of what's a specific intent crime and what's general intent. And the code, the Model Penal Code, and as reflected in the drafts of the other subcommittee, are very purposely avoiding the kind of specific intent, general intent nomenclature that has caused so much trouble in the common law. And if we could avoid it by keeping that word specific intent out, but that's not one of our words of culpability. It would be adding a new word and adding all kinds of problems, I think.
We have four culpability. Mental states for, and that is intentionally, knowingly, recklessly, and negligently.
Dave, as an example, there are these public welfare offenses where there's no mens rea at all. If you mislabel drugs, you're guilty, whether you were negligent or intentionally did it or not. It makes any difference. If you did it, that's a crime, like running a stop sign. There could be a crime of attempted mislabeling under this draft, but if you said with a specific intent to commit the crime, you couldn't do it because it's not a specific intent crime. I suppose this is one of the examples then of where you could not reach in the crime of attempt that kind of conduct.
Well, do we want to reach that kind of conduct?
No.
You talk about a malum prohibitum situation where the law simply says thou shalt not. It's pretty hard to purposely engage in that conduct. Well, I see what you mean.
See, it's written so that you can.
Okay,
it doesn't say you have to have any intent at all. It says you purposely engage in the conduct that constitutes that crime.
This is a practical matter. Frank is going to have to, when he's prosecuted, he's going to have to dug on the approval of the crime and then reason back from it to the attempt, aren't you?
Well, that's true now.
When you're trying to prove a crime of attempted burglary, you're almost going to have to prove the burglary then reason back from that fact to the stage of attempt for what you're asking.
You're going to have to allege that they attempted to break and enter Dave Frost, the resident of Dave Frost, located at such and such resident. So.
Yeah, but the kind of act you're going to have to prove the attempt is going to be a lot easier on you than it is in the
criminal
law.
Than it is now, yes.
Without a specific intent, it's going to be a lot easier.
Hmm?
Without a specific intent requirement, it's going to be much easier.
Why it's done this way.
I think that
you have the prosecution. It's bad enough trying to find purpose from having possession of burglar's tools to prove that.
Well, how do you
but
normally,
I think Don's language
prove
of striking that which constitutes such crime, or in going and striking the other as long as there's a definition of conduct, I think that takes care of the objection.
What is your definition of conduct, John, again?
Conduct is means an act or omission and its accompanying mental state.
Well, are we going to incorporate in this section vagueness as to what is the required accompanying mental state?
Oh no, I don't think so, because our general definitions will apply to all of the specific crimes, including attempt.
Most of the attempt statutes that now exist don't have, are not clear at all about the mental element with respect to the crime of attempt. Some, like Illinois, use specific intent, which is very restrictive. Some just finesse the problem by not even talking about it. This is a studied attempt here. Attempt to put something in the legislation that was more of a guide to the prosecutor and the jury.
Defense attorney.
I guess really.
Well.
Well, if we took out that from which to which.
Okay, you want to take out, after the word conduct, you take out the beginning with which and end with act.
Yeah.
Okay, fine.
Attorney.
Now let's make sure that I'm, a person is guilty. It'll read, a person is guilty of an attempt to commit a crime when he purposely engages in conduct which constitutes a substantial step toward the commission of the crime.
Okay.
I would so move.
Second? I guess we don't need a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Done.
Scared me again, Frank. We're in the same side. I'm scared.
Well, you see, Dave, there's kind of a problem in this statute, right? When you start thinking about things in relation, not in just relation to that guy sitting beside you at the council table, but start thinking about the good of society, your thoughts change.
Turning from a persecutor to a prosecutor. Only after five.
Any other questions about section one? What do you feel about George's solution of having the various steps, which
yeah,
may be very
right.
Question in the commentary rather than in the section itself?
Well, I think that kind of goes along with some of the things we've done in other sections, or rather than over lengthening the act. actual statute but in the commentary.
I think it's a good idea. Well, just wondering, practically speaking, the commentary would not be a part of the statute.
That's right.
So that you would have within...
We've talked about this earlier, that the extent to which we're going to have to circulate the commentary, and obviously lawyers and judges are going to be looking at the commentary very carefully from the outset. As I recall, Tony mentioned that we'd arrange to have it published in the pocket parts or whatever, so that it would be readily available. Really, this comes up at the non-suit stage or the directed verdict stage, and seems to me you shorten the code by having this in the commentary. It doesn't bother me at all to have it in the commentary. I kind of think I prefer it there.
That's good.
And it adds a little flexibility too, because it by the old statutory construction of the exclusio rule, you aren't tied to that.
That's
old
right,
concept.
Yeah.
And if in fact the courts want to develop a little law to add to this list, there they may.
We did the same thing on our arson, you remember?
Mm-hmm.
Explicit commentary on
Well, remember the
after 2 days of
in one of these responsibility sections, we've got the jury instruction in on the form of the verdict, the insanity verdict, as legislative history.
How about section 2?
Section 2 reflects what I now believe to be the law of Oregon and the law generally. It makes no substantial change. The old cases that come to mind here are the empty pocket cases, and the old defense was you can't steal from an empty pocket, therefore you can't be guilty of an attempt to steal from something that's just an impossibility, a factual impossibility. Well, I've cited an Oregon case here that refuses to acknowledge the old factual impossibility defense, although I could not find one on the so-called legal impossibility, which would be demonstrated, I suppose, by attempting to bribe one who you think is a juror who in fact is not a member of the jury. In a sense, that's factual impossibility. It's kind of viewed as the legal impossibility. The status of juror is not there.
Well, in a sense, Oregon does have impossibility as a defense when we start talking about assault in relation to an attempted battery.
Yeah.
Because
I knew we'd get back to assault. I had a note on that right here. Is this? I had a note that says, is this pro-knight or anti-knight? See assault.
See assault.
This good night.
But there, I mean, I know that the place down there, we've had instructions on assault with intent to commit rape, that they were one of the biggest defenses that we've had used is that they were so drunk that they were unable to get an erection, so therefore they couldn't have consummated the crime. And of course, assault with a dangerous weapon, the gun has got to be loaded.
Yeah, but there can be an attempt. Clearly, we've got a case on that. There can be an attempted assault with intent to kill. This is the State versus Wilson case. And the court, as I recall, said that if you can identify assault as a substantive crime, and that's pure incomplete conduct, obviously, you haven't shot anybody. If you can identify that readily and reasonably as a crime, and I think we can all agree that's a readily identifiable crime, no matter whether it's with or without present means, then our court says you may also have an attempt to commit assault with a deadly weapon. And that was the very facts of that Wilson case, where the fellow had the shotgun.
That's
never got close enough
no.
to his wife.
But you see, now we've gone clear away from the Wilson case because we've said that assault now is battery. Is a completed act.
Let
me
know.
And the statement
that
assault is an inchoate crime,
it's
the putting in fear that's the act and the conduct. That's not inchoate.
Well, is that the law now in Oregon? I thought it was putting in fear had nothing to do with it.
No, it's part of the recording.
You see, they said that assault was a completed act in and of itself. See, that was the question on appeal in State versus Wilson, was that assault was an attempted battery, and you cannot have an attempted attempt.
Well, that was the question, but the court wasn't bothered by it. It said you can, in effect.
Well, they said no, they didn't. They said assault is a crime in and of itself, and so you can have an attempted assault.
Okay, and I'll agree with that.
But that was what was bothering me when we were talking about you changing assault to battery. I guess I missed that comment.
Was that
in
the subcommittee?
No, it was at the last commission. Last commission meeting.
Unfortunately, I wish I had.
That's what bothered me about that. But under this definition of attempt,
it doesn't bother this.
We can get back to that attempt to commit an attempt. You see, we go back far enough so that there's no problem.
Well, yeah, the only thing, it's going to be attempted assault as we define it now under the assault draft is all. It's not going to, they're not incompatible. I mean, your section here isn't incompatible with our assault draft.
Well, just to fill me in, is the definition of assault now the putting in fear?
No, it's the completed act of battery. You got to start thinking of assault not as the swinging of the fist, but hitting the fist. Assault is not shooting the gun, it's the striking of the bullet.
Well, it's essentially the same rationale as California's following that.
Okay. Well,
as a policy decision, do we want to get away from the factual impossibility situation?
You mean go back to it and let it be a defense? Well,
I think it's so many situations where if I think my checking account only has $10 and I write a $25 check, but in reality I can't add or subtract and I've got $30. I have attempted.
You didn't do it purposely though. Your defense would be not purposeful criminal activity.
No, purposely I thought there was only $10 and I wrote a $25 check. That was purposeful criminal conduct, I would think. Now in fact nobody got hurt, and that's what we're looking at, is what's the effect in society. Your case of the voodoo doll, which you have in the commentary. Black magic won't do it. I don't think society has heard it. The guy sits there for 3 years and sticks pins in that doll.
No, that's right. But sooner or later, it's going to occur to that fellow that isn't being effective.
Yeah, but we don't make ineffectiveness a criminal act. If we did that, we'd have 95% legislature.
Well, I recognize the policy argument. I certainly recognize the policy argument, and there's strong support of it in the cases, but I would point out that it's the older classical view of the law. And that the Model Penal Code, again emphasizing, turns away from the emphasis on the act and looks at the person's personality and what he wants to do. And if he, in fact, shoots a gun into an empty bed, believing a person to be in the bed when, in fact, the person's 50 miles away, his personality, he's just as dangerous as if the person had been in the bed, because he's going to try again. This is the kind of case we're really talking about.
We don't know he can try again. That's a fallacy of it. We don't know the guy sticking pins in the voodoo doll is going to become dissatisfied with his ineffectual means and use a more effectual means. And I don't think the policy of the criminal law
I would say this, Dave, that as long as you didn't write another check that went over your $30, I don't think that would ever come to the attention of anybody.
Well, if we're making it a crime, it should. Crime should be prosecuted.
The only reason it isn't a crime is that, as posed by you, is fortuity. Somebody was lucky that he wasn't in the bed or that he didn't have the $10 in his pocket. And the person who evidenced the antisocial conduct, the asocial conduct, goes scot-free until he's successful. Well, I think that the police ought to be able to intervene and get that fellow off the streets before he is successful.
But he hasn't done anything.
But he's tried.
He's tried, that's right. Well, then we don't need a crime of attempt. He hasn't done anything until he opens and takes the jewels out of the safe.
No, he has when he breaks and enters the house.
Yeah, but he's got the ladder.
Not really, he hasn't committed the crime that he went for.
Well, he has the ladder up against the window, and I don't think he ought to let that guy off scot-free.
The wall safe may be in another house. He might think that the wall safe is in the house that he's trying to break into, and in fact, it's not in that house.
You got the wrong house.
So you go and get the right house the next night. If you let him, you sit, the police just sit there and watch him on the ladder and say, well, it's a factual impossibility here, we can't touch it.
Well, of course, that argument, the burglary would be complete and the breaking. You don't need the jewels inside.
No, but he's just put the ladder up against the window. He hasn't broken or entered.
No, he hadn't broken and entered. This would clearly be an attempted burglary.
In every case, you'd raise the defense that, my gosh, the guy was mistaken. He intended to hit the house down the street.
Of course, you'd find it pretty unusual to get a very sympathetic ear from the jury on that kind of defense.
Yeah, but you might get a more sympathetic ear from the judge.
It's a matter of law. The jury
taken away from them, can't they? I suppose they can always kick over the traces.
Jordan, now I realize that your illustration here about the voodoo doll, it's just for illustrative purposes.
It's for fun, mostly.
Yeah, but just for the purposes of argument, what this would be attempted what? Attempted murder?
And I point out that no prosecutor would ever bring the case, probably.
Not unless the guy suddenly died.
Yeah.
Well, you know, or unless you had a victim and you could prove that this victim believed in black magic and
exactly,
was very susceptible.
Precisely, and that's known, that does happen in these cultures in Haiti and so forth. The victim of this thing will die because he believes in it. One of my students came up after class once and said, there's even another problem. Suppose that victim who believes in voodoo kills the voodoo man out of self-defense. What kind of a problem you got there? I said, thanks a lot, you know. Glad you didn't ask me during class.
Oh, well.
Any other questions on section two?
Gee, Dave, it's so seldom that we go along with the Oregon law. You know, I kind of like to think that we ought to do it here. Poor Oregon law takes a terrible beating from us.
I feel like it's a good position to reason towards a compromise.
I'm just suggesting we vote on it as we go along on each section.
Renunciation of defense. This sounds like an ancient church doctrine of some sort.
In camera.
Well, are we going to, we probably should approve each one of these.
Any objection to one and two so far, as amended in the case of section one? If there's no objection,
just
one and
little.
Two are approved.
Not enough for a no.
Okay.
Just enough for a stage.
It's more of a solicitation than conspiracy.
I'm sorry, I was reading. Are we proceeding? I'll proceed with three.
Yeah.
I was unplugged there.
Yeah. Section three.
Okay. This will, in a sense, reverse majority rule, and not in Oregon's jurisdiction because I found no law on it at all. But we'd assume that the classic rule is that renunciation is no defense. That once you cross that mythical line, that taking the substantial step, strongly corroborative of your purpose of committing a crime, that you have committed a crime is therefore complete, and there's no going back. And when one thinks of it in this light, if you rob a bank and then you take the money back and say, I'm sorry, it's too late, you've still committed a crime. You can't make restitution on that kind of a crime. Well, in a sense, that's what we're doing here. We're allowing him to excuse his criminal conduct, but there's one big difference, of course. He hasn't committed the substantive crime yet. So as a way to encourage the one bent on a course of criminal conduct prior to the time that he completes the criminal goal, he may renounce his goal if he does it in such manner that he obviously is not postponing it, or if he does it on his own voluntarily, he's not interfered with, in other words, and frustrated by the police.
Yeah, I was just going to say, as the police officer runs up, the guy yells, I renounce.
Too late. He runs at risk of his defense. It's just simply too late. It has to be, the word voluntary is in here, and let's see, sufficient to accomplish the avoidance. It must be that. It must stop the crime. He can't shoot the gun and then say, I renounce, as the bullet is on the way either, because he hadn't stopped the crime from being committed.
In other words, in our hypothetical here, he's got the ladder up against the window, but he decides, no, this is not my bag, and so he's taken the ladder down and headed back for his pickup, and he's apprehended.
If he can then convince the jury, which is unlikely.
Talk the jury into it, that's a defense.
It's a defense. It's unlikely that he'll, on the facts as you put it, that he'd get away with it. The jury probably wouldn't believe him, but at least he ought to have the opportunity, I think, to have the place of repentance and to be able to prove, or at least to submit his evidence, that he did repent to avoid the commission.
Are you mellowing, George, or does Section B just indicate the thinking of the commission?
I wondered if you'd noticed that. I think it's consistent. Myself, my earlier stand, because it is so subjective here,
this is really a subjective defense. If it can be said that there ought to be an exception to the rule, and this is where I would make it, that is the burden of proof exception. I have not changed my inflexible position with respect to burden of proof on the question of sanity or insanity.
I had to read that and then reread it, and then when it didn't say beyond a reasonable doubt, I decided, well, you did write it.
You thought we'd been tampering with it before.
Yeah.
George, I want for the defense to be raised, there must be a total avoidance of the commission of the crime.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we don't need the word reasonable between everything necessary. It shouldn't be everything reasonably necessary.
Well,
if the chain of events has been started over which the initiator has no control, he could not claim renunciation.
That's right. He's got to stop.
Well, that's, yeah, that's
well that, but that's if mere abandonment is insufficient. In the hypothetical right. I have, of course, if they believe him, his abandonment by carrying the ladder back to the pickup is all he needs.
But if you were talking about arson, say, and he planted an incendiary bomb or something like that, he'd have to get the bomb out completely in order.
I'm sorry, what was the first part of your hypothesis?
Well, an arson, or an attempted arson. And before the bomb goes off, he goes back and recovers
snuffs
the bomb.
The fuse,
and takes
yeah, that's all right. There's going to be a
he's
very...
He's not confused and drops a lighted cigarette and burns the match.
Well, that'd be negligent arson then.
We'll get him under reckless burning then.
Yeah, right. There's going to be a real distinction in the way we use the word abandonment later with respect to the conspiracy defense. Because it will be possible to abandon the conspiracy without being excused from conviction, but it will start the running of the statute of limitations and a couple of other technical defenses, but will not excuse unless the renunciation for conspiracy is of the same kind that prevents the conspiracy from coming about.
That's what raised the question in my mind, and I came back to this one to see if we could, but you can't, I think it's fine.
Let me ask this, George. It's my recollection that earlier, when we were talking about affirmative defenses, and a few instances where I think we sold them over your protest, it's my recollection that we didn't use the term affirmative defense because it was inconsistent with the terminology or something. I wonder if you,
well,
with the proposed terminology under the Model Penal Code.
Model Penal Code's affirmative defense.
Didn't call that.
Is not the, well, the affirmative defense now is a production burden. That is, the defendant or the state has the burden of producing the evidence, then the burden is shifted as to persuasion of the other party. Now,
yeah.
I've been away
but,
from the affirmative
but
defense
the affirmative
definition.
Defense thing that you defined to us when we were talking about something else was that the defendant only has the burden of injecting the issue, and then the state has the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt. But this isn't what you mean here. This is talking about what we now think of as an affirmative defense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
well,
I'm not.
That's what had me
I'm
quite
not bothered
surprised
by the terminology.
About
the
I think I.
I move we adopt the artfully drawn section 3.
Any objection to section 3? I had a nice note on this one too. Namely, a Pratt fall.
Pratfall, section 3, all right. You mean the subparagraph B? Part?
Correct. Section 4.
He'll start thinking like the rest of it yet if you just get out of this.
All right, we finished with the crime of attempt. Hallelujah. Now, as I read the statutes in Oregon, and I certainly would stand to be corrected, there is no general solicitation provision in our statutes.
Except for prostitution or something.
Beg pardon?
Except for prostitution, and there's some solicitation on that.
It's a term of art.
It's used in a little different sense.
A little different sense. Soliciting and so forth. Well, anyhow, this does define it in very short, and we'll read it. Let's see what's... You know, I suppose the unusual thing about it is that it does create the crime in Oregon for the first time. The crime of solicitation, where it does not exist by virtue of, as in Oregon, the common law crime of solicitation wasn't brought in because we don't have common law crimes and there's no statutory crime. Therefore, there's no crime And to get at it, to make it criminal, Oregon and several other states, in its definite minority, dub it into the law of attempt, so that when you solicit somebody to burn down the barn, I got the case, the Taylor case, I don't know whether I discuss it here or not. Yeah, when you solicit somebody to burn down the barn, and give him the materials to set the fire and the money to set the, do the job for you, this is generally held to constitute the crime of attempt in Oregon. So in a sense then, it makes solicitation equivalent to the crime of attempt, which I think is a bad mixing of concepts, and certainly would the crime of solicitation would not necessarily constitute the crime of attempt as here. Merely saying to somebody, will you go set fire to that barn for me tomorrow? That is the crime of solicitation, but certainly it hasn't progressed far enough that along the line to be the attempt yet. It hasn't risen to the other inchoate crime of attempt. Now it may, of course, but not on the grounds of solicitation. If in fact the person you solicit agrees to do it, there you have the crime of conspiracy. And if the person goes to the gets the match lit before the police intervene, the solicitor is guilty not on the grounds of attempt, but on the grounds of complicity, of aiding and abetting in the setting of the fire.
Or the attempt.
Yeah, but not the crime of attempt to set the fire, because he didn't...
Well, didn't in the Taylor case...
He didn't get close enough
really
to himself.
Wasn't that aiding and abetting thing that he was...
They didn't say that, but I think they should have. That's the way they should have decided the case, I think, rather than the... But here again, the court was faced with the practical necessity of making solicitation criminal. It wanted to reach what that guy had done. And the only way it could do it was to dub it into what the law of attempt was, or to make it part of the law of attempt. And this this has been criticized by Model Penal Code and by Perkins in his text as a very artificial way to make solicitation really a crime when it's not identified as solicitation itself.
What degree of proof do you have to have to make, let's say, a jury question of solicitation? Is it enough if the solicitee testifies?
Mm-hmm. It's criticized for that reason, Judge. That they say, well, that's too easy to fake that kind of a case, but then multiply that through the criminal law and you see that a lot of places the word of one person is maybe enough to convict. The conspiracy would be the same.
He's not an accomplice, I suppose, in the sense that we have our present accomplice statute.
No, not yet, anyhow, not for that. He can become an accomplice depending on what his solicitee does later on with respect to the crime that they're aiming at.
How do you anticipate this crime would be graded and overall grading structure?
Yeah, that was my question.
We take care of this.
What about the attempt? What did you feel on attempt?
Section 14, as I recall, the policy with respect to all three crimes, attempt, solicitation, and conspiracy, is that the penalty will be the same as the crime attempted, solicited, or conspired. In other words, if the solicitation to murder, the ultimate penalty for murder applies for the solicitation. And same with attempt.
The judge takes into consideration that...
Now that's a change from the Oregon law.
No, it says half.
Yeah, that's right. Some states, well, let's see, conspiracy in Oregon is 3 years maximum. But that will no longer be true. It doesn't make sense, really, when you look at it, to have a different penalty. A person who's going to conspire to commit murder won't be deterred by treating the word conspiracy or the crime conspiracy differently. He'll be deterred by the penalty for murder if he's going to be deterred at all. So I see no reason for differentiating for the crime of conspiracy. It isn't going to have much effect on what he does.
Wasn't murder the one place you did differentiate?
Well, maybe it was, yes. I think in the cap of two or three, kidnapping, murder, and which made it a second degree rather than a first degree felony.
On solicitation, it would appear to me there are two basic policy questions. The first one is, do we want a crime of solicitation itself? Mm-hmm. And if we do, secondly, from a social standpoint, should it be for all crimes or limited only to felonies? How bad is it to solicit a misdemeanor? Is that really criminally or socially reprehensible conduct? I notice that the New York, California draft limits it to felony. The rest of them do not.
Anytime kid goes out and asks somebody to buy a beer for it.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, shouldn't we reach that conduct? That's the question. Don't we really want to reach the kid who causes the other kid to get the trouble started? He's not going to be punished any more than whatever the penalty for the misdemeanor is.
Because the problem is that you've got the free will of the person, the solicitee, yet to do anything really socially harmful.
Will you buy me a six-pack?
Right. No. But the crime's been committed, will you?
That's right.
I don't think that's a...
Well, it's, you're consistent with your factual impossibility, the fact said.
You'd be wrong about the system.
Well, no, and the crime you're talking about is not the crime that the solicitor might commit, had this been completed, but what the solicitee would be guilty of had he... In other words, say that minor in possession is a misdemeanor, but with a different penalty than furnishing liquor to a minor. Is the minor who solicits the furnisher going to be subject to the penalty for furnishing liquor to a minor?
It's impossible for the one who wants or is to have going a purchase to be. He's the minor.
We'll have something called contributing to the delinquency of a solicitee.
Yeah.
Well, George points it out in the commentary too. The drunk at the party who goes up and taps somebody else's wife in the backside and says, let's go out in the car.
What crime is that?
Well, it should not be a crime in Oregon, because I hope that you don't define adultery and some of these sex crimes. You know,
we've mailed out the sex offenses draft. Maybe I had a chance
to
read
it. Yeah, I think it's eliminated.
It is eliminated in our
fornication and adultery and all these private morals problems are eliminated from the crime.
That hasn't been into the subcommittee yet. That's just the...
What we ought to do is pass that one while the churches are busy on the tax exemption.
Yeah, that's right. Attention is elsewhere. The Model Penal Code comment has some interesting statements which are responsive to the points you're raising. And points out, for instance, that one of the reasons to define solicitation as a crime is because it is so allied to the crime of conspiracy. It is an attempt to conspire when you say, will you do this? Well, if you agree, then we have much more serious kind of crime anyhow, because we have people involved.
If
whenever there's
agree,
a group,
right.
It's more dangerous.
Then you've got the conspiracy.
That's right, but we want to repress the guy going around to create the conspiracy, too. We want to get back to him. That's the policy, anyhow, of the code, and I subscribe to it.
The Michigan draft makes downgrades this one level, is what it does. Criminal solicitation is a Class A felony if the offense listed is first-degree murder. It's a Class B felony if the offense listed is a Class A felony, and so on down the line. They would in effect downgrade it one step, which I suppose makes some sense.
But isn't your judge, your sentencing judge, going to do that anyway? It's a practical matter.
Well, I suppose so. Yeah.
Trust the prosecutors and the judiciary.
Well, of course. Well, there's another problem we ought to think about. Solicitation runs into the First Amendment problem, too. And God knows, down on our campus, I can hear the students scream about a crime like this, because they're out soliciting the use of marijuana from the stand of the free speech platform every day, or they're out saying, let's burn down Johnson Hall, or something of that sort. And very likely, they are committing the crime of solicitation, and I personally would like to see us reach that kind of irresponsible conduct with some kind of a crime in Oregon. If it's, the solicitation must be concrete. Now that is one of the definite restrictions. It says causing another to engage in specific conduct constituting a crime. So you can't say students revolt. That's not specific enough. It wouldn't be punishable. It wouldn't be a First Amendment problem there at all. But if the speaker standing there haranguing them says, let's go home and get our get some gasoline and go down and set fire to the ROTC building or bomb the local reserve officer's training place, then we are getting into a specific conduct. Now, I don't want to put this in terms of students.
You do see a button that says smoke pot. Are you soliciting?
Well, I don't know whether you're commanding and encouraging and so forth in that point. Let's see, what are we saying?
course, that's one of
the purpose of causing another to engage in specific conduct might be, I don't know, close. And
should we have a
prosecutor can probably cause a lot of trouble with that if you wanted to.
Well, I've often wondered about, you know, there's one radio disc jockey that I've heard on occasion that says, particularly it seems more like on Fridays when I've heard him about something about, don't let the traffic bother you, something, you know, have, you know, drink before you drive or something like that. I'm like, God, he's encouraging people to go out and get potted and drive.
Yeah. Well,
as a practical matter, is the DA gonna go around and pinch somebody who wears a button that says no pot?
DAs are politicians. They get elected. The present company accepted, of course. Around election time, I think it kind of itchy. Particularly, I would think in a college town like Eugene.
Well, in Eugene, obviously, the district attorney stays as far away from the campus as he can. And rightly, he closes his eyes to a lot of activity that could be riotous or generally criminal, disorderly conduct. Because he knows that you can't win that kind of an argument, even at the polls.
For some legislative history, I would move that we delete Section 4.
Dies for lack of a second.
I don't think the rules require
seconds. Yeah. Well, I think we got so few members here.
Before we get to that, should we discuss Section 5, renunciation of solicitation?
Well, I think it would fall with it, wouldn't it?
Well, it's the exact same concept as renunciation for attempt. And if you throw the 4 out, you throw everything out with respect to solicitation.
I must say I'm bothered by the idea that, and I think you'd have some really horrible First Amendment problems if you prosecuted the kid wearing this button that said smoke pot. All you gotta do is read some of these underground newspapers a while and see what might fall within the van, but I'm, on the other hand, I'd hate to see the whole thing go off because,
well, in light of the definition of attempt, I think you need this now. Because in Oregon, the solicitation to commit murder or solicitation to arson would not constitute attempt under our now adopted definition. And you're going to have to turn the clock back, I think, to the attempt laws that exist.
You wouldn't have a substantial step.
Wouldn't be a substantial step, strongly corroborative of the criminal purpose, I don't think.
In the Taylor case, there would not have been a substantial step.
I don't think so.
And that's the only solicitation type case you found.
Yeah, well, yeah, and it really wasn't, so I found it under attempt, actually.
Well, it would seem to me that that getting a guy, soliciting him and paying him the money to burn down the house, that at least to me, I wouldn't be afraid to stand up and argue that that was a substantial
well,
step.
Maybe it would be. You certainly aren't prevented from doing it, from arguing it. The attempt definition is broad enough to allow the argument to go to the jury.
Would solicitation be a lesser included?
There are provision in the later sections for that. You can't convict for more than one of the inchoate crimes from the same course of conduct. It's possible to have a solicitation, conspiracy, and attempt all out of the same transaction. You may not convict on all three. You can prosecute on all three, you can bring the charges, but you've got to elect at the end which one to convict on.
Well,
and, in fact, if the crime is completed, and you may prosecute for the conspiracy to the crime as well as the crime, but you can't convict for the conspiracy because it, in that case, merges with the offense for which you're going to convict.
Now,
part of the same criminal conduct.
Now, with respect to this attempted arson, I'd like to point out now our arson draft contemplated that 164090, which covers an attempt to burn property, would be repealed by our arson draft with the understanding that it would be covered, this kind of conduct would be picked up as an attempt. Now the language in that statute seems to me part of it would be covered by our arson draft, but certainly not all of it without this solicitation section. And then it says any person who willfully and maliciously or wantonly attempts to set fire to or to burn or to aid, counsel, or procure the burning of any dwelling house, building, or property, etc., is guilty of arson. Mm-hmm. But it has a 3-year maximum on it. And this language about counsel or procure, it seems to me that you'd be hard pressed to show that was a substantial step towards arson.
Yeah, I'd hate to see.
Well, let me say this, that I think that there may be some questions about solicitation, but I feel that it's necessary that rather than, if it's going to be deleted, rather than we delete it here, that it should go before the full commission.
That sounds like a good idea to me. Any further discussion on the motion to delete section 4? All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No. Defeated.
I would move that we limit section 4 to the solicitation for the commission of a felony.
Any discussion on that motion?
In other words, your smoke pot, that's only using, it's only a misdemeanor.
Possessing is a felony.
Yeah.
I think, of course, it's a matter of policy for the committee, but I would remind you that sometimes the distinctions between misdemeanors and felonies is pretty arbitrary. That is to say, it doesn't really reflect the seriousness of the misdemeanor. And there are a lot of very serious misdemeanors that would now escape this crime that I don't think you really would want. Of course, you don't want the crime itself, but I mean, in general, if you're going to have the crime of solicitation, that some of these misdemeanors certainly are a substantial kind of crime.
Now, we are also going to have
shut off
year. Way back, and we're talking about petty offenses or something.
Well, whatever. If the motion is adopted, obviously later on it'd have to be changed to reflect. Let's say we go to the Class A, Class B felony type definition. You'd have to change it there. What I think Dave's position is that wherever you have the breaking point between felony and misdemeanor, that anything that's in the felony class could be solicited and anything that's in the misdemeanor class couldn't be.
And our classes of crimes now stand at felony, misdemeanor, and petty misdemeanor. Those are what we are categorized as.
What's it? Is it 30 days or 6 months on the petty misdemeanor?
30 days.
30.
I'm inclined to think that again, that this ought to be something for the full commission to take up. I'm not sure
it was 30 days on the violation.
30 days in violation.
And which would not be a crime anyway, but it was misdemeanor was 6 months.
I'm inclined to think that what we might do here is send it to the commission with the, not necessarily an alternative, but with a suggestion that the commission consider limiting it or not. Frankly, I think I'd want to go down the list of crimes and see, because you might get somewhere along the way and here'd be some conduct that you'd really want to prevent the soliciting of that conduct, and some other conduct you wouldn't want to worry about.
Well, if we're going to put the policy question to the full commission, then I'll withdraw my motion.
Let us submit it to the full commission
a note that Dave has a minority report.
Well, no, a note that we'll present the full commission with a either or proposition. You can do that, can you not?
Oh, sure.
Can I suggest a grammatical change here without going to substance, but the language, the purpose again, could we insert, think about using the language with the intent to cause, again using purpose, because we use intentionally or with intent as one of our culpability states.
Jim, would you excuse me while I go make a basis to the Senate, and I'll be back in right away.
Okay. Is the purpose of causing with the intent to cause another door?
Well, okay, that would have to be changed all the way through then, won't it? I mean, if I'm going to take out purpose, I'd want to put in whatever you're using now all the way through my draft. I thought we were going to wait until we got through, or have you changed your policy on that? Has the commission adopted that?
The commission has not adopted that, George.
They probably will.
It's been approved by the subcommittee and has been circulated.
I have no objection to changing it, except that if something went wrong and purposely got put back in the commission, then I'd have to change it again. In a sense, it would be kind of a...
I'm not sure I understand here.
You want to use intent instead of purpose.
Because you don't define purposely?
Yeah, right. We don't define purpose, but we do define intentionally and with intent, mm-hmm. as both meaning the same.
Yeah. Does that include now the purposely and knowingly levels of the code, or just the purposely?
Just includes purposely, and then we also use knowingly as a separate
thing. So you're just using another word for purpose.
Right. We're using the language that the New York code uses, which is intentionally rather than purposely.
Actually, we're talking about this solicitation. And the problem with the freedom of speech and this type of thing, where you say that with the intention or intent or purpose of causing another to engage in the conduct, that you'd have to show, and a jury'd have to be convinced that the person advocating this wasn't just puffing, making noise, he actually intended for him to commit this crime.
Sure, causing another to engage in specific conduct.
So there is a protection against everybody that says something being charged with the commission of a crime.
If you're going around making bad jokes, like most of the stuff that says smoke pot, they're just being kind of a smart aleck joke, you know.
Yeah.
No intent, really, to have people go out and commit the felony of smoking pot or possessing it or whatever it is.
Your disc jockey would probably say the same thing.
Well, do you have any objection to changing making the change, George?
No.
Any objection to changing?
I'll make that change all the way through.
It means with the intent to cause rather than with the purpose of causing.
Where are the other places you're going to have to change that, George?
Well, in the attempt statute. And conspire all the way through, I use the word purpose occasionally, and I think I may use other culpability words. Are they the same?
It was conduct that you had the definition of.
Yeah, well, conduct, I mean.
Intentionally also, and I thought we had inserted intentionally in section 1 and 2, didn't we? Instead of purposely.
Yeah, I didn't understand that, but I now will. Any place I use that word purpose, I'll yank it out and go through the subsequent revamp here.
Okay. Any other question on section 4? If there's no objection, we'll approve it with the understanding that we'll send it to the full commission with the alternate proposal. Section 5 is the same, isn't it, as
enunciation
of intent?
Yeah, right.
Any question about section 5? Right, section 6.
Right, now we move into the third inchoate crime, conspiracy. The present definition in Oregon is pretty sketchy. It doesn't really tell us much. This is a very new kind of look to defining in legislation the crime of conspiracy, not only this section, but the many succeeding sections. I forget how many there are. I broke the model penal code down into shorter sections and made more sections out of it. The conspiracy section of the model penal code is about 3 pages long, and I saw no reason for that, so I broke it down. Now it consists of about five or six sections in our draft. Now, the emphasis again here, Dave, is on the individual. And you probably will want to raise the same policy objection, because under present drafts of most classic or traditional conspiracy statutes, and certainly true of Oregon, although we have no cases on it in Oregon, statute is when two people agree, when two or more agree to commit a crime. And this has been construed to mean that there have got to be two people who have culpable, who have the mens rea to want to do the crime. So that if in fact one of them is an innocent agent or immature or insane or for some reason can't commit the crime, in Oregon and in many states under the old kind of statutes, you could not convict the person who proposed the conspiracy. Now, the Model Penal Code, again consistent with its approach to the dangerousness of the person to society and reaching that person through a unilateral approach, says that when one person agrees with another to commit a crime, whether or not that other person is guilty or capable of culpability is immaterial. It is no defense to the, with respect to the person who proposed the criminal conduct and who does have the mens rea of the conspiracy. Now, that generally is what this first section is all about, although it has more language in it than that.
One question I had was, other than the basic policy question, where you have agrees with such other person or persons that one or more of them will engage. If I walk up to you and say, I think I'll go knock off the bank in the corner, and you say, well, okay, and I walk off and do it, has there been a conspiracy?
Mm-hmm. Not unless you are purposely engaging in it with the purpose of committing the crime. I can't, it's practically impossible to say whether when you just simply agree, whether you are purposely conspiring to commit the crime. Probably not.
Well, if the purpose of promoting or facilitating, I suppose, might take care of my question. Yeah. What would the agreement
be? Well, you said, you around the corner,
we have
see if there's any
close
police.
Right, now, very clearly the conspiracy.
Closely aligned.
Signal
isn't
me if there are.
Closely aligned to the problem you raise is what is facilitation of a crime, conspiracy. That is the selling of the sugar with knowledge that there is a conspiracy to make whiskey, or selling of a gun to a person with knowledge of the fact that he's going to go out and rob a bank. Does that make the person who sells the gun guilty of conspiracy? Not under this draft, because your purpose is not to facilitate the crime. Your purpose is not to commit the bank robbery yourself. Now, you certainly are culpable in the sense that perhaps if you don't sell him the gun or if you don't sell him the sugar, he won't make the whiskey. But
under your previous reasoning, I would think that that would be a crime.
Well,
you talk about soliciting, that the guilty actor, the solicitor.
But the storekeeper, if he goes out and says, why don't you make whiskey and I'll sell you the sugar, that's solicitation.
Or I'll give you sugar and bring me back half the whiskey.
Well, that'd be a conspiracy.
Well, then that's a conspiracy,
right?
Because you have the purpose to facilitate the crime and to take part in it and to receive profits, and it pretty well qualifies on all score. But where a mere aid, in other words, with knowledge, is not going to constitute the crime. Now, as I point out here, New York does define that as criminal facilitation. But the question you get into is, when should you get out of the realm of business regulation and in the realm of crime? How free should the business community be to sell at a regular rate sugar, or to rent at a regular rate a house which may in fact be used for prostitution later? Now, if you rent at a higher rate, or if you sell sugar at a higher mark, you may, as a matter of law, show, the prosecutor can show, this is purpose, because look at the profit, the extra profit he's taking. He has a purpose to commit this crime himself. So it can be inferred from what you do as a storekeeper that you really did have the purpose. This direct sales case that I cite here came to that actual conclusion in the federal courts.
Well, what's the difference in if with the purpose of promoting or facilitating its commission? Now, surely, if the guy is just selling sugar and wonder, well, gosh, how come you're buying 10 sacks of sugar from me every week, and it doesn't know the guy's making whiskey, and then so the store owner asks him, well, how come you're buying all this sugar? He says, oh, I'm making whiskey over here. Well, and from then on out, isn't his sale, was that facilitating the commission of the crime?
No.
He doesn't have the intent.
But if he hides the invoice or something like that.
Or he raises the price.
Or cuts the price.
Or cuts the price, yeah.
Or tells the revenuers that, no, I ain't sold George any sugar for a long time, or anything like that, which would be proof of facilitation.
Or intent.
Show that he was part of the plan.
Sure, right.
He's facilitating it by keeping up the sales, but it isn't his purpose, really, his own personal purpose, to commit that conspiracy to commit the crime of making whiskey. So he hasn't really agreed with purpose. Intent. I can't get over using purpose. But when I say purpose, I mean intent.
Yeah,
can I be read that way?
Right, definitely.
All right.
We'll splice the tape according to that.
Just so
in the minutes, every time after purpose, we'll have parentheses intent.
Well, of course, you know the law of conspiracy is a difficult, complicated field, and I.
Sure is.
Suppose you'll have guys tinkering over this section for a long time. I can just see Howard Lonergan sitting down and going through this with a fine-tooth comb saying, aha, they missed it, you know.
George, I'm chasing my tail, and maybe you can help me. We have a solicitation to conspire. Now we have conspiracy by solicitation in sub B. Agrees to aid such other person or persons. Planning or solicitation to commit.
Yeah,
you've got an example, I think, in common terms, George.
Yeah, solicit to conspire.
Attempted.
Well, it's possible.
The solicitation must necessarily follow before conspiracy, just solicitation. Because here we're saying that we're making. Oh, sure, man. Conspiracy by solicitation must come before.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
I knew something was wrong with that. Thank you.
Okay.
I'm glad
you explained it, because I couldn't.
Yeah, now I didn't understand your answer, Dave. I understood your question.
It was an intuitive answer.
Actually, this first section does not open, with the exception of shifting from the bilateral necessity of having two people with the requisite culpability to the single, emphasis on the single. This section doesn't open up all the problems that we're going to open up later when we get to venue, severance, and joinder. Those are the procedural problems that are going to cause the greatest difficulty, I think.
But does this essentially do away with the so-called over-the-act requirement?
Yeah, that's right. I suppose we better talk about that. Now, the statute requires an overt act, but it's such an inconsequential act that's under the case law. Anything, going out making a telephone call or meeting a guy on a street corner, it has no relationship, doesn't res ipsa loquitur or equivocality, it just doesn't mean anything, but it's an overt act. Really, the essential act has already taken place, the agreement. That's identifiable, a verbal agreement. It's concrete, it's easy to identify. I think that's all that's enough. You know, the Model Penal Code in the minor offenses of conspiracy requires an overt act. They do require, in the third degree felony and in the misdemeanor category, an act.
Would this conspiracy apply to anything? Felonies, misdemeanors,
yeah,
whatever?
Right. That's right. Same conspiracy to commit a crime.
What about conspiracy to commit the crime of driving while intoxicated? Could you prosecute a bartender on this statute?
I was thinking of this when we were talking about the sugar salesman and the whiskey.
If with the purpose of promoting or facilitating his commission, he agrees to aid such other person.
Well, I would say you're kind of faced with a situation where the bartender and giving him the drinks, of course.
Well, of course,
know that the guy is driving, I guess.
You make that argument, but when you look at the word purpose and intent to commit the crime of drunken driving, it'd be pretty hard to say and prove that a bartender really purposely wanted you to get arrested for drunken driving.
No, he didn't want you to get arrested. He didn't want you to get arrested.
Yeah. He may facilitate your drunken driving and a homicide that would follow, but it's not his purpose.
But when the tavern's clear out in the alley somewhere, you're there by yourself and you're drunk and the bartender cuts you off. So what's he doing? He's sending you out.
I've had those kind of experiences, Frank. Tell me about that.
Well, we've got several taverns here in Metcalfe. Ford up in Kings Valley, and the Alpine Tavern down in Alpine, where there really isn't anything but a tavern, you see, out in the country. So the bartender cuts them off and sends them down the road.
But not with the intent.
Well, do you want to cover that kind of situation? Is there a substantial feeling on the committee to make to follow New York's lead and have a crime of criminal facilitation?
No.
It goes pretty far.
Oh, boy.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, they've only got a limited amount of ground out here at 2605 State Street. There isn't any present plan that I'm aware of to substantially enlarge it. And if you started prosecuting bartenders and all that kind of thing in this deal, the only reason I raised the question was whether or not it might fall within the
system. Leave the bartenders about where they are now, and then leave that up to the Liquor Control Commission to handle that kind of situation.
Kind of raises another question, too. When you say agrees with such other person, does that require some mutuality of agreement?
Mm-hmm.
Does that require capacity on the part of
one
of those agreeing?
No, I'm sorry. The word agreement is still in there, and I suppose if you look at it as strictly, you can't have an agreement unless there are two people.
It's not a contract term.
No, it's not a contract term. And agreement, in the code sense, and this becomes clear in section 12 or one of the other sections, which points out that the incapacity of the one you agree with is no defense to the person who actually does have the culpability. It's made explicit there. It's implicit here.
But that incapacitated person is now guilty of conspiracy.
No. I mean the person. As between the two, if one of them is insane, he can't be prosecuted for, he can't be convicted of conspiracy because he's irresponsible. Or if he's under the age of whatever our maturity draft is now.
14.
If he's under 14, he can't be, he's immature and cannot be held guilty of a crime of conspiracy. But if one agrees with that 14-year-old, the one who does the agreeing, who has the capacity, may be reached by the crime of conspiracy. Although there is only one, in the sense, technical sense, legal conspirator.
It takes a willing submission of one conspirator. If the father says to the 16-year-old son, you drive the getaway car, I'll beat the living daylights out of you.
Well,
is
that
the 16-year-old
then
son?
Then you get into the question of duress and necessity, and that's another article. And boy, I don't know. I don't understand that article at all, frankly. But I don't think it would apply here, because it'd have to be voluntary agreement, or it would not be culpable. The duress, short of murder, I guess it is, excuses the crime, short of homicide.
Any
so
other questions about Section 6?
Fascinating necessity provisions in this
one
model penal code that you haven't gotten to yet.
That's a
standard. Do you want motions to adopt to go along with it?
Well, should we discuss the succeeding sections, George, do you think? Suggested, but
might
all
might be something.
We've agreed on everything up to 6. Why don't you go ahead with 7 and 8 and so on.
Okay. This is an attempt to identify by statute that which has previously usually been existent in case law only. It's a complicated situation. It's designed to balance, recognize the great burden of the prosecution in showing the intricacies of a conspiracy or several conspiracies which may be related as defined here, so that the jury can be given the big picture of the particular little guy, the little defendant in that conspiracy. But here again now, on the other hand, the defendant, there's a very careful balancing that has to go on, because the defendant may become swept up in this large prosecution that the state has put on, and much to his harm and unfairness. These two sections then set out the scope of the relationship, Section 7. And it limits now, it is a limit in a sense, on some of the broader conspiracy holdings, so that if I conspire with Frank to rob a bank, and I know Frank is going to conspire with Dave, or I know that Frank is going to get two gunmen or two drivers, I may not know their names, but I do know that there are going to be other people. I can identify them when I agree with Frank. Then I'm conspiring with those two people. But if those two people then go out and conspire perhaps to kidnap one of the tellers, then the relationship of me with the conspiracy to kidnap is broken by this. I don't know those people are going to conspire with others. I don't know the other people. It's an attempt now, this is the balancing effect, it's an attempt to give the defendant a fair shake. If in fact we're going to allow a different, larger numbers of conspiracies to be joined and prosecuted to show his relationship, then there ought to be an end to his conspiratorial relationship. And that's what this is attempting to do.
Well, don't we give guys some responsibility on something if he knows it's something that's reasonably foreseeable in the act of the crime as far as you're in the aiding and abetting? You don't have to commit a specific crime if you know that I'm not going to rob the bank. You don't know I'm going to conspire with others, but you know that I need somebody driving the car and...
Then I'm conspiring with them, if I know that.
Conspire with them because it's reasonable that I go out and get somebody to help me do these other things.
That's right. And their statements, their hearsay statements, can be used against me. That's really what we're talking about now. A lot of the problems are the admissibility of hearsay evidence and admissions of parties that aren't actually in court. And that's an accepted principle in the law of conspiracy, and this draft certainly does not change that. It allows to stand the present status of the hearsay evidence rule exceptions on conspiracy. But it does affect it, however, as I've indicated, by stopping that chain of conspiracy somewhere down the line, past what I know you're going to do, or past what I reasonably can assume you're going to do.
That's reasonably necessary.
Yeah, right. So obviously, somebody's got to get the gun, and somebody's got to drive the car. You're the plan man, for instance, and I know that. Or you're the outside man, maybe.
Of course, the practical effect on the defendant is going to really be non-existent. It's not going to make any difference to him whether he's charged with conspiring with two people or 19.
Well, yes, it is.